This is Art Moves. Art Moves is a series of curated conversations at the intersection of art, innovation, and social justice.
Each week we'll be talking with the innovative thinkers and doers who are forging new ground in the creative arts or redefining what it means to be creative.
I'm Tony Williams.
And I'm Eli Kislansky.
And we're your host for Art Moves. Today we'll be talking with a unique vocalist, songwriter, composer, and educator, Martha Redbone, who'll speak about the message in her music and more on this episode of Art Moves.
Welcome.
Thank you.
You said you were born in Manhattan first, but you also grew up in Kentucky.
Yes.
That's a bit of a cultural shift. How old were you when you left Brooklyn?
I was very little. So I was born in Manhattan, but raised in Brooklyn until about 3 years old. And then went to Kentucky and stayed in Kentucky until sixth grade and came back to Brooklyn for middle school and high school. And
there's
so
a little more to that too, right? Let's talk about your roots.
So I'm Afro-Indigenous, as they call it. They have so many different terms, but I call myself Native and African-American. And my dad is African-American, and my mom is Native American. We're from Appalachia. We're from Kentucky. And I was raised in a small coal mining town, small but infamous, known as Harlan County, which is mostly known for the strikes and what they call Bloody Harlan Wars. So with the union workers and the coal miners fighting for their rights. So that is the land that I'm from. I was raised by my grandparents there. My grandma's from that region originally, and then my grandpa came up from Alabama, Mississippi, early 1940s to work in the coal mines. A lot of people, what they don't know about Appalachia, when you think of Appalachia and you know, in these regions, you know, of Black Mountain, are that they think that, you know, they think of the people in them Dar Hills as just Scots-Irish and just like, you know, all the derogatory terms like, you know, rednecks and
hillbillies
and all of that. But what they don't know is that, first of all, the land in itself, Black Mountain, is the original Cherokee Shawnee territory before Indian removal to the place which is now known as Oklahoma. And the other thing that they don't know about it is that Black people and African people have been, you know, freed slaves, went to work in those hills as early as the 1880s. And this is something that most people don't know about. So we have a rich, rich legacy in those hills. And my ancestry goes way back. And also, even on my dad's side, my dad is African-American and Lumbee, which is from Robeson County, North Carolina, which is, you know, another one of the largest tribes on the East Coast, and I'm descended from there as well. But a lot of the politics, you know, with the United States government has redefined and reclassified people's heritages and, you know, made up these kind of social constructs called race, and they made these guidelines, you know, for people. So there's a long, dark history of people being removed and being declassified and having your heritage taken away because you have the one-drop rule of any African blood. And this stems back from, you know, Thomas Jefferson and on to Andrew Jackson, who enforced it and then created this, what they call the Racial Integrity Act, where a lot of people's identities were changed overnight in the census rolls. And that's when you fell under being, you know, you're being classified from Indian and changing that and removing that post-Indian removal to being MU for mulatto and then COL for colored. And
yeah, the 116th
all of these
rule. I'm very familiar with that.
The blood quantum and all the blood quantum rules that Tony's talking about.
Right.
There's a lot of lawsuits too, right? And some,
well, there are lawsuits, but they were,
no,
you
I mean,
know,
but to be reclassified, right?
Yeah, like, but there were a lot of lawsuits, but not, they're based on, you know, based on corruption.
You may not
and
have had power
might
either.
Not have had
no,
not
power. But I want to kind of circle back to the music, right?
Yes.
I want to understand how you blended that. How did you, what's your journey as an artist? Because it started very early.
Yes, my journey through music was to, you know, because of, you know, my heritage and embracing these cultures, you know, I was raised by my grandparents, my maternal grandparents. My parents split up when I was very young, and I was raised here in New York City, you know, by my mom. And so, you know, through that bloodline, you know, this is a single mom, single parent household who worked very hard in order to give, you know, us just the education and, you know, have a good life here. And compared to how it was when they were growing up, you know, in Kentucky, in Harlan County. And so I always felt like I should honor everything that I am and all that I am. And when you're an artist and a creative person, you embrace that. You embrace your surroundings. You embrace your culture. You embrace where you come from, you know, and you're also representing your family too. So there's a great sense of honor and responsibility for that. And it's not just to celebrate, you know, where I came from and to celebrate them for their struggle and their work and to recognize them for that, but also to set an example and lead by example for future generations, so whoever comes after me. So when I'm someone's grandmother, you know, these kids will know who they are and where they come from and what their story is. Because unfortunately, we live in a country that is an expert in erasure.
Mm.
Interesting. Yeah, interesting comment.
Yeah. And so it's important that we keep these stories alive. And the only way that we can keep our stories alive is by oral history. I mean, we've come from a, you know, legacy of oral histories that go all the way back to Africa, let alone here in as the original caretakers of this land. But it's our responsibility to keep telling those stories because they, as you can see, you know, they could always be government legislature that erases us overnight, and I've seen it within my own family.
What aspect of any of that, and also from other sources, really fuels your passion for your work?
I think the music and for me it's the music and the storytelling, and it's revealing what some people would have often referred to as uncomfortable truths about American history, but for me it's just about the truth.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that it's important to celebrate this in music because it's not just talking about, you know, a torrid past, but it's actually celebrating our resilience despite the struggles of the past. I feel that, you know, it's a celebration of who we are and of our staying power and our, you know, responsibility to who we are and embracing our culture. I mean, I don't know a single black person or an indigenous person who doesn't honor where they come from or talk about the culture of, you know, of their family story.
You mentioned resiliency, but what about pain? How do you write about that? How do you address it in your work? Do you address it in your work? Talk to us about that.
For me, I write about pain in many different forms. You know, as a songwriter, I'm able to tell stories that can tap into human feelings. And I also am very fortunate enough to have a partner, you know, a co-composer, my partner and my husband, Aaron Whitby, who is great, who comes from an English-Jewish background from Estonia. And so he has a huge legacy of their own pain and the struggle of Jewish people throughout the world, and so we're able to tap into these emotions no matter how, you know, conjuring up whatever we want to convey. So if we're working on, say, a musical and we want to talk about something that may bring an audience to tears, you can write a sad song, you know, or you can, if something is so painful, sometimes it depends on what the story, where the story comes from. For example, when I talk about erasure and during the Indian removal period and post-Indian removal period, and this racial reclassification where after genocide, for the ones who stayed and the ones who survived and how they were erased from census records, no longer considered this particular race, and then another 10 years later and then called another race that was made up and, you know, and constructed and then erased from there. There's also the business of whiteness in America where, you know, many people from Italy who came over were considered black or, you know, Sicilian, and then how the business of becoming Sicilian to now becoming white in the 21st century, those same people whose skin tone is the same as mine are now seen as white, you know, so there's all of that, and also how Jews became white, you know, this, you know, all these different groups. So this is whiteness is a business in America and has always been a business.
You're listening to Art Moves on WNYE 91.5 FM.
Art Moves is co-produced by Brick Arts Media and pre-recorded at Brick Studio in downtown Brooklyn.
We're speaking with Martha Redbone about her music and her life experiences.
So if we put all of that into a song, sometimes the history of it, when we're doing our research, is so painful and so sick and cruel. Instead of getting really angry, I find it absurd. I see the absurdity in racism because race doesn't exist. The goalposts are moved constantly, depending on what the powers, you know, that be need to fit. So these goalposts were even moved in my own family for different census records. The same people in Harlan County, you know, so you see the absurdity of racism and where that lies in order to fit a particular agenda that the legislation and power wants it to be.
If you could talk to us about growing up in the regentrified or gentrified Brooklyn, you know, and then the influence that had in terms of your music, because we know that you came, you know, you have roots in Harlan County, Kentucky, but then you moved and really dug in to urban life here in New York City.
As you do as an 11-year-old kid, you know, who wants to fit in with your peers. I think I call it pre-gentrified Brooklyn because that's what I consider the back in the day, old-school Brooklyn.
Yeah, it's interesting you say that because, you know, I was born here, so I've been here a long time. And I was like, what do you mean? In fact, I always think about, you know, you can almost date Brooklyn.
You can.
You know, by
decades.
By decades, yeah. So, you know, apartment houses that have those look like castles on tops. Then all of a sudden you have those kind of metallic gateways that you see in Southeast Asia. You know what I mean?
That's right. That's right. Yeah, you really can. You can tell all of those things just like by the architecture, by, who has the token with the little Y cut out to get into the subway, you know, and get on the bus.
I miss those.
Way before Metro cards.
Little breast ones.
Also, playing stickball in the street.
Yeah.
And not having to worry about a bus coming and running everyone over.
Well, that was the second base job, the old car.
That's right. So there's the old school Brooklyn where you could, you know, your parents, once summer vacation was out, you know, a lot of the black kids got shipped down south for the entire summer. Like the last day of school, we saw all the black kids in the neighborhood say, bye, see you in September. You know, but the rest of us kids whose parents had to work, like my mom and everything, we didn't go, you know, down south for the summer. We were here. And, you know, when your mom has to go to work because she has to be to work by 9 years old, she's like, get out of the house. I'll see you at 6. Do something with the day. So we'd be running around. We were running all over the city.
Does any of that have an influence your music today, or is that just a separate kid?
Absolutely.
Thing, or,
I think, you know? I mean, for me, I feel very, very blessed that to have a childhood in a rural place like Kentucky where you could, you know, sweep up leaves and then jump in them and, you know, just have like the country life. You know, I think that was a really beautiful way to spend a childhood. And then I think I feel extremely blessed to have been able to come to a city like New York City with all its diversity and cosmopolitanism and, you know, ripping and running the streets like we did, you know, as a preteen and then a teenager and throughout high school, and to be able to have the arts at your fingertips here in the city. To me, growing up as a teenager in New York City, nothing can compare. It's like kind of being in the Willy Wonka of culture here. Yeah. So I feel, that's how it feels like to me. Yeah. So I feel very, very blessed that I've had the best of both worlds. I consider it. And I think the music has, not only the music, but everything about the atmosphere has expanded my mind, because I feel like, you know, in the years as a musician, I feel like I can cover such a wide spectrum of styles and sounds and things, because I've lived them as well.
I want to talk to you, too, about your spiritual connection to the work that you do, you know, because you strike me as a person that has a belief in the divine, and I'd just like to know, how does that weave in to the music that you do?
You didn't see my horns under my hat.
Yeah, I didn't see them. I didn't see them.
I am spiritual, and I believe in all creation, and I guess I was taught that all creation is equal.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we're the two-leggeds that we call ourselves. You know, my grandpa would call us the two-leggeds. You know, and the four-leggeds are animals, and I think it's our and the sky and the, you know, birds and everything and all of creation. We all, it's our kind of responsibility to look after each other so that they work in harmony. And but I think what changes is Christianity teaches us that humans have dominion over other living things.
Yes, a very Western thought.
And so you're immediately, when you use that word that comes from, you know, comes from Christianity, comes from the Pope, you know, and, you know, that just, it comes from that side in Europe. It's having dominion, dominating over something. So there's immediately a hierarchy. And that's where this, our spirituality from home is different from that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
Because we don't see it that way. And so when you're taught this hierarchy through Christianity, any form of Christianity, not just, you know, from Catholicism or anything, but Church of England and all of these different things, you know, I think when you're taught this hierarchy, then it's very easy to create hierarchy over other living things and other people as well, and put these hierarchies of which humans are better than these other people. And then you can, then it makes the, then it moves from there to where the people in power decide that certain other forms of humans who may have different skin color are not considered human. And that's where we get these things.
You know, but is that something that you would think is at the genesis of Christianity, or something that developed all the time? I mean, it's kind of like the word propaganda, right? Propaganda didn't have this nefarious interpretation until it hit England in World War I. Its original came from the church, which is the propagation of the faith. That was an organization inside the church, God knows when. So I wonder if that's something, is at the genesis of Christianity, did they have that hierarchy
built in? From the very beginning, built in from the Pope, and it's called the Doctrine of Discovery.
Doctrine of Discovery, right.
And that Doctrine of Discovery gave the European explorers the right to travel to other lands and murder people in the name of Christianity.
I'm hearing a lot of history in what you're saying. So you're a musician, but are you also a historian? Because it seems as though but you know a lot about, you know, again, history and where things started.
You know, when you come from a people who have been erased on both sides, when you come from, you know, I'm a descendant of enslaved people who were stolen. And, you know, I go back to one of the most profound statements during this COVID pandemic for me, which surprised myself, was the eulogy of by Reverend Al Sharpton that he gave during George Floyd's funeral. And he said, "I am reminded of the history of this country every time I write my name."
You're listening to Art Moves on WNYE 91.5 FM.
Art Moves is co-produced by Brick Arts Media and pre-recorded at Brick Studio in downtown Brooklyn.
We're speaking with Martha Redbone about her music and her life experiences.
As a black person and a brown person, all the names that we were given do not come from where we come from. They were names given by who owned us. And when you have that as part of your legacy for your children's children, you ask questions and you want to search for the truth of how this came to be. And so that's, if you want to call me an historian for that reason, it's because we came from stolen people. We came from genocide. I came from genocide, attempted genocide, because I'm still here. So these are all the questions that that I have, which make me want to know and reveal more truths. Dave Chappelle always says, you know, in America, we could all play who suffered the most contest.
Right.
Right. You know.
Right.
We can choose to live in the cycle of pain and, you know, the generational trauma. And that's very easy to do. We can do pain very well. But to do the resilience is the greatest triumph, and to begin properly the process of fully healing.
So let's talk about your collection of music and how it deals with all of this, or share with us some of the songs that you've written. Was that a hard question?
No, I'm just thinking of
everything,
because there are different themes.
Right. And is that how you create, from the themes, meaning when you put your music together?
Yeah. I think so. I think, you know, at a particular point in time, you know, you think of something that fits a particular subject matter. And, you know, when you're making a music project, you have to, you know, it's like writing a book. Mm-hmm. You have to have a focus. Otherwise, you're just, you know, we're not just kind of, you know, sitting under a tree, you know, like strumming a guitar and thinking, oh, I think I'll play this today, man. Yeah, this sounds really cool. You know, that's not what, that doesn't work for me. That's not part of my process that way. I think that, so you know, you make a focus and you think about things that you, and stories that touch you. And not everything is coming directly from myself either.
Mm-hmm.
I do believe in the power of storytelling, but there's also many stories in the world, and there'll be things that you read about and books that you read that inspire you.
Could you give some examples? I mean,
yeah,
you know, like a particular title? And what
yeah, I'm just
about.
Thinking about the project that we developed with the Public Theater called Bone Hill. And this is a theatrical concert that Aaron and I created. And the songs go through not only a historic timeline from the early stages of you know, early history of a family story all the way through modern times, but we're actually going through a musical timeline as well. So we take you on a journey from traditional songs, from traditional Cherokee language, using some lullabies and vocables, and then we go from there to you know, to mountain music. I talk about this one drop rule. We have a song called One Drop, and about the census records and racial reclassification and things like that, and it's a song about the census man is coming to town and he's going to judge you by your hair, because they did. They used to do the pencil test and also paper bag test.
Paper bag brown. Yeah, your paper bag.
The paper bag test and the pencil test.
That's true, really? Wow.
And again, the absurdity of that and the pain of that.
And ignorance.
And the ignorance, the hate, you know, and all of that. Mm-hmm. So we made a kind of absurd song about this.
Mm-hmm.
you know, called the Census Man. Also, the One Drop song is another one where we're saying we're one drop in the name of the law, and but we made it a big gospel song that says in the name of the Lord, you know. So we're saying we're all one drop in the name of the law, you know. So things like that.
You fuse blues and gospel and folk in your music, right?
Yes. Yes, and soul.
And soul.
You know, R&B is always there. You know, the spirit of Aretha Franklin is one of my all-time heroes.
Yeah, who would you like to collaborate
with? It was her.
With? Aretha? Aretha? Yeah. Aretha was the one you'd like to collaborate with?
I would have loved.
That's a great question, right? No, but is Aaron Copland an influence? Because I know he did Appalachian Spring, and he did a bunch of other things, and he also incorporated a lot of traditional folk songs into his music.
Yes, I like Aaron Copland, but no, he didn't influence that.
I wouldn't think he would be, but just
but his, like, yeah, his but similarity. I do love that music.
Yeah. No, it's interesting you talk about this thing about culture and stuff like that, and remember this new story I read about these protesters of Native Americans. In some public park, and there was some people who were yelling at them, they should go back where they came from.
Yes, there was a story of a family who were in, I can't remember what state, maybe New Mexico or Arizona, where they were in a Walmart and speaking to each other, and then someone shouted at them, hey, you know, you're an American now, you know, you speak English, and they said, we're Navajo, we're speaking Dene.
Yeah, right. So, looking forward, is there any kind of musical forms or experimentations that you're working on that you'd like to talk about?
Yes. I'm currently a recipient of the NYC Women in Music grant.
Oh, congratulations.
Congratulations.
And so,
congratulations.
Thank you. Yeah. And that happened just before the pandemic. And so now that we are able to record and be in a space together, I'd like to continue with that and finish that album project for New York City. So that will be a nice cultural record, and I'll bring some of my other female singer-songwriter friends and sing some traditional music or make some vocables and do like a kind of spread of things like that. I have a couple of follow-up projects. I have one follow-up project to the William Blake Appalachian project that we did, so that's something new. And then I also want to...
Is that the Garden of Love?
Yes, the Garden of Love, Songs of William Blake collection. And then I also want to do a follow-up to our Skin Talk record, because...
You said Skin Talk?
Skin Talk album that we made, and we kind of created this style of soul music, you know, of rhythm and blues, mixing it with traditional music. And so we'd like to go back to that. And so we have a lot of irons in the fire. We're also composers for Colored Girls Who've Considered Suicide When the Rainbow Is Enough by Entezake Shange. And
that goes back a long way.
Yes, it does indeed. And so we should be returning as soon as Broadway opens up again. We'll begin working on that. We're actually going into recording, is it in 2 weeks' time, to record Bone Hill, the concert album, too. So there'll be an Appalachian project there.
Appalachian. I used to say Appalachia. We say Appalachia.
We say Appalachia.
Appalachia. Appalachia.
Well, you know,
you're not from that place.
Yes. I want to just thank you so much, Martha, for coming in and sharing your story in a deeply kind of personal way in some respects. I've very much enjoyed everything that you had to say.
Thank you.
This has been Art Moves with your hosts, Tony Williams and Eli Kaslansky.
Find some art that moves you and share it with someone.